So welcome to another talk here at the Chin Sui Caves. And don't, have you already packed your bags yet? Please unpack them. There's a long time yet before we finish off. Was it maybe 25, 26 hours? Which is 1,500 almost minutes. That's a lot of minutes. 90,000 seconds. That's a lot of seconds you're wasting. So see if you can squeeze every second out of this retreat. Just even in one moment is enough to get enlightened. So don't throw away 90,000 seconds. It's a strange thing that people are always way ahead of themselves. Even I notice this in airports. The same people who queue up wanted to get on the flight first. They're the ones who want to get off the flight first. And I was thinking, if they want to get board the flight first, they must like aircraft so much that they should be the last ones to leave. But it's nothing to do with liking to be on aircraft. It's always just to be ahead rather than just to be where you are. One of the first times I recognized this was always being ahead of oneself, was when I was a school teacher, just for 1 year. It was a high school in Devon. And as I mentioned to many people, anyone who teaches teenagers will lose their hair and will think very seriously about leaving the world. Just those of you who are parents, just having one or two teenagers in the house is enough to worry you. Having a whole school full. But anyway, that was good fun. I learnt a lot. But there's one of the teachers there that he, you know, was not happy being a school teacher. He liked teaching, but it was all of the responsibility and dealing with other problems which the kids had was just driving him nuts. So he decided to change his job and managed to get a job as in the civil service. And it was a nice job, well paid, but he had to wait until he'd finished his contract with the school before he could go and take up this other job. I remember him telling me, it was about 6 months before he would be able to get a new job. And he told me one day, and it really sort of hit me, I remembered it. He said, I caught myself this morning wishing away 6 months of my life. Wishing away the time he was in a job he never really wanted to be, so he could get to a job where he did want to be. He was way ahead, dreaming of the new job. And so 6 months he was wasting. Of course, as soon as he realized that, he realized that he has to change his attitude. Because sometimes at our present moment, our situation, we think, oh, in just one more day, then I'll be able to have those who aren't already going back to Singapore today. One more day I'll be having a nice dinner. And you're already planning what you're going to have. You're wishing away so much of your life. And so that's why that sometimes it's great to learn how to be in this present moment. Of course, sometimes we always think that once, you know, I can have dinner whenever I want, get up when I want, sleep when I want, you know, then we think, oh, that'll love me happy then. But the point of the matter is, it's not. It's the same. Because some years ago, a very interesting story and interesting insight. There were these two, happened to be Thai sisters. Young, good looking, just good English, well educated. And they came to see me for some counseling. And one of the reasons, why, especially Buddhist people, go to monks for counseling is because we're cheap. We don't charge anything. If you've got the same high quality service in this outside world, oh, you get, you know, thousands of dollars, you know, for like getting Ajahn Chah personal counseling. It did happen once, I'm just going on a tangent, but I was invited it was the biggest human resources organization in Europe. And they're having a big conference in Docklands, in London. And they had headhunted me, seen me talk, and said, we want you to give a keynote at our next conference. So they actually paid all the airfares to take me from Perth to London, put me up in a nice hotel, and so that I could give a keynote address at this big conference. And I was just getting ready to give my talk, and that was when one of the organizers was actually approached by one of the staff, and then she approached me and said, there's a couple of people at the gate trying to get in for free. They claim that you're their relatives. And I said, what? They never told me anything about that. And so I went down to check, and it was my brother and his daughter, my niece. And, you know, because it's a brother and niece, you know, I just sweet talked them. And he said, well, actually, you are allowed one friend to come in, but not usually two. And I said, oh, come on, I'm not charging you anything. You know, just I don't get a fee for this. Oh, okay, you can both come in. And so once my brother and niece, you know, came in, I took them aside and scolded them. Why are you embarrassing me like that? You're a banker. You know, you've got enough money, you can afford to pay the entrance fee. And the same as you, your daughter, she was actually organizing events at a university. So why didn't you cough up and pay? And he said, do you know how much they were charging each of us just to come in for your talk? Was £300 each. And I said, well, okay, I can understand. I understand why. But then I thought, thank you for that information. Now I understand my market rate. So how many hours are we talking? per person. But anyway, that was really good fun. But anyhow, that just these two Thai girls, they came in. And I asked them, what's the problem? So the elder, you know, that's usually seniority, the elders in Asia. What is your problem? And she said, my problem is my husband. My husband, oh, it's so difficult, you know, to live with a husband. Oh, it's, you know, just so hard to sort of, you know, be, you know, give him this and then he wants that and just, oh, just driving me crazy. And I really think he would maybe, you know, attempting a trial separation. She was thinking, this is serious, having a lot of suffering with her husband. And all of those of you who are married, you know what it's like. And so I told her, and I said, well, you know, that husbands are husbands, you know, what did you expect? When you actually sign that marriage certificate, did you actually look at the small print on the bottom? When you sign that marriage contract? A husband's a husband, that's what they're like. So, and anyway, I tried to say, well, just don't look at the two bad bricks, look at the 998 good bricks. Yeah, you know, you can always change relationships, being a bit more forgiving and being more kind and developing his good qualities and not arguing. Not just the, what I was saying the other day about the, it's not about you, it's not about me, it's not about them, it's about us. Which actually does change a lot. But also about the chicken and the duck story, you know, the quack quack. You know that one, don't you? Yeah. So just because it goes quack quack doesn't mean it's an octopus. But if he says it's a cow, then it's a cow flying through the air, okay? It's just not worth the argument. But instead, you know, we understand what's really important in life and understand that you're not perfect, he's not perfect, no one's perfect. But anyway, I gave all the usual ideas and counseling. And then I turned to her younger sister. And that's when her younger sister started complaining that she was single. You know, You know where this is going, don't you? And she was always trying to find a guy and looking for someone to share her life with. And she was a nice woman, but, you know, it would go on for about a month, and then for 6 weeks, and then for some reason it would just all fall apart. It would break up. And that happened again and again and again. She was getting very frustrated not being able to find a partner in life. And so, you already know the solution. And I suggested it to them. I said, look, both of you, you're sisters, and you grew up together. You know, you share everything. Elder sister, you've got a husband you don't want. Your younger sister wants one. Swap. To a monk, that's logical. But I think, what was that in Star Wars? Not Star Wars, Star Trek, Dr. Spock. Remember Dr. Spock in Star Trek? To boldly go where no monk has gone before. I used to watch that before I became a monk. Is it still going on, Star Trek? Okay, amazing. But anyway, the Dr. Spock was always really logical. Couldn't understand human emotions. Same with me. I think I must be, what's it called, a Klingon? Is that a Klingon? Okay, I must have been a Klingon. But anyway, well, it makes sense. And of course, they totally refused. But that's when you started taking it deeper. And I told the older sister, you've got a husband, and you're not that happy with him. You have what we call husband dukkha, husband suffering. And all of those who are married here, you know what I'm talking about. Husband suffering. You get husband happiness as well, lots of reward too. But, I said, if you get rid of your husband, then you'll have what your sister has. Single person suffering. You don't get away from dukkha that way by changing, you know, your situation on the outside. Because that's what it's like, isn't it? Some people, you know, you may be a guy, you just have a beautiful partner, and ooh, it's really hard, so you dump the partner, and then you have single guy suffering. And does the suffering really end? No. So now you've got being on retreat suffering. Tomorrow you'll be having not being on retreat suffering. Have you ever noticed how this world works? So, what are you going to do with your life when it's like that? You know, you're very young, think, when I finish school, then I'll be happy, and when you finish school, I've got to work now. It's really hard work. Then you're a junior monk. I remember being a young monk when I was in Thailand. You've got pictures of me. I was really thin. Thin, bony, and exploited. And sometimes I'd look at the line of monks, and I look at the top line of the monks, and the ones at the very top were fat. You know what's going to come next? And they had all the best cushions, the thickest cushions. Me, I was small, bony, and I had to sit on the hard concrete, no cushion at all. I thought, this is unfair. If the people who need the cushions, you know, the young monks, or the nun or something, you need the cushion because you're bony and small. But no, the head monk's got all the cushions. Food. The head monk got the best food. First choice. And they were already fat. And down the bottom of the line, me, I was really hungry and I just got the leftovers, just the gravy and nothing else. Just the rice and just maybe a little frog, and that was it. That's really unfair. They should give the best food to the junior monks for two reasons. Number one, they need it more. And number two, those senior monks, they're all in line. They don't have any craving, but as a young monk, I still had craving. Give me a chance. They would appreciate it. How could they appreciate the beautiful food? So that's really... Number three, those senior monks, they just sat all around all day, just talking to people, have their photograph taken, signing the books. And me as a young man, I had to do all the work. You know, sweeping and cleaning and doing all this stuff. And they just sat there all day just talking. And I thought, that's really unfair. Because they're the ones who decided what work we do. But they never did any of it. They told us to do it. So I thought, when I become a senior monk, then my young monk suffering would be gone. And it's true. Now I'm an old senior monk, I don't have young monk suffering. I get the best food, lovely cushions, don't have to do any physical work, people actually do it for me. And but now I think, oh, I wish I was a junior monk again. Now I have to spend all my time giving talks, eating all this food, just having my photograph taken every day. And that's another example. Junior monks, you have junior monk suffering. Senior monk, you have senior monk suffering. The people decide to disrobe, they disrobe monk suffering. You don't get away from it that way. And just so you're the president of the BGF, you've got president suffering. And you know what I'm talking about. And if you decide to resign and let somebody else take over, then you'll have not being president suffering. Are you rich? If you are rich, you've got lots of money, don't you have rich person suffering? I've seen that many times. You know, I've just been to rich people's houses, and it's not like being in prison. They've got guards on the gate with machine guns, barbed wire. And I think, is this guy a rich guy, or is he in home detention, or what is he? Are those guards trying to keep him from going out, or keep people from coming in? Either way, it just looks like a prison to me. Yes, luxurious prison inside, but they just can't go wherever they want. They can't just go and have a meal somewhere without somebody recognizing them. This is one of the problems, being rich. So they lose all their money, become poor, and they've got poor person suffering. They have to walk, they have to travel, not economy, they can't even afford that baggage in the hold. They have to walk, they have to be hot, whatever. They just, so whatever it is, it's not the situation you're in, being on retreat, keeping 8 precepts, 10 precepts, 227 precepts, or no precepts. Being old, being young, being female, being male, being a great meditator or just a hopeless meditator. Have you ever thought like that? I said, oh, I just wish I had jhanas, enlightenment, then I'll be happy. And then when you've got jhanas or enlightenment, then people are always poking you, saying, yeah, you're not really jhana, that's not really enlightened, and causing you all sorts of trouble. And sometimes even people have suggested, said, Ajahn, you must be a good meditator. Can I ask you, please get in jhana, and I'll put a gizmo on you to see what's actually happening in your brain when you're in deep meditation. So, look, I'm a monk, I am not a laboratory mouse. To be poked and prodded. So he just can't get away as a human being from suffering. Not if you don't know how to make peace with your life, wherever that life happens to be right now. So that's one of the reasons why it really doesn't matter your situation in life, married or single, monastic or not monastic, alive or dead. This is for all the ghosts in the room. But what matters is just how you deal with that. Are you happy to be here? Content with your lot? It's not perfect, but it's good enough. You look at your husband, not perfect, but good enough. The husband looks at you and says, this girl, well, no, she's getting close to her use by date, but good enough. In other words, you don't have to be perfect to be loved and to be at peace. And that's one of the reasons I love telling the story. I tell this story over in I think in the BGF the first night, but this is the old story of the forest. Whenever you have an opportunity, go and have a walk in the forest. Because nature teaches you so much. than nature, just have a look first, see if you can find a perfect tree. If you're going to marry a tree, you're going to get the perfect one. Just know, this is just a simile. If you want to get a perfect tree and live with them for the rest of your life, what type of tree would you get? Perfect one? Really straight, with everything just in the right place, with no marks or damage on the bark, with all the leaves nice and green. Try to look for a perfect partner in life. Do you ever think one exists? Maybe in Hollywood, maybe in Disneyland, or whatever, but in real life, every tree in the forest is twisted and bent and damaged. Isn't that the case? So those of you looking for a guy in this world, every guy in the forest of humanity is twisted, bent and damaged and imperfect. Same as every girl as well. So where will you ever find a perfect partner if that is what you're looking for? There was a nice growth story, but this is actually from the suttas somewhere. Don't ask me where, because I've already harassed Ajahn Bhumali by email trying to find out references. That's his job. He's my librarian. My researcher. But anyway, there was this young guy who really wanted to become a monk. And his parents never wanted him to. You know, that happens here as well in Chinese culture. They're always really happy when somebody else's son becomes a monk, but not theirs. Zema's daughter. So anyway, he was having an argument with his parents. He said, I really, really want to become a monk. No, you know, you are our only son. You have to become get married and have children to take over our family business and our line, our lineage. And he said, no, I want to become a monk. So they had an argument, so they came to a compromise. He said, okay, I will not become a monk and I will get married if you can get me the perfect girl to marry. And they were very wealthy, they had connections, and okay. But he also said, if you can't find a girl which is perfect for me, then you'll let me become a monk. He said, yeah, sure. So it has to be very beautiful. You know what guys are like. Very beautiful. And he said, okay, we can get someone beautiful. And she has to be a good cook. I said, okay, we can get a good cook for you. Even if she doesn't cook, we can always train her. And she has to be very sweet and charming and never argue with me. That's a difficult one, but I think we can manage that. And all of these requirements, but the very last one, the parents said, okay, we give in, you win, you can become a monk. Because the very last one, they couldn't find any girl who could fulfill that requirement. And the last requirement was that she doesn't fart. Of course everyone farts, guys as well, monks as well. We do it too, and nuns I'm sure as well, of course you do. But that's why I always say on retreats, out of compassion, if you've got digestive problems and you pass a lot of smelly wind, you know, it happens, okay? We're being realistic. So if that's you, then please do not sit at the front. Sit at the back out of compassion to all those people behind you. And now you know why those people sitting in the back maybe you're sitting there. This is kind of a gross story, but now that was the truth. There's no one really perfect in this world. So if you're looking for perfection, you're looking for the wrong thing. Instead, you're looking for contentment. Something completely different. Content, in other words, just, oh, this may not be the best retreat center, but it's good enough. It's very simple to see all of the mistakes in this retreat centre just like bang, 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 and just boom, whenever it's... Victor, I do remember the old BGF centre, that, you know, where it was next to where they built a big shopping centre or something. Remember that old one? Yeah, the previous one. And I remember just going out to give a talk somewhere, really late coming back, 11:30 when I came back to the room to take a rest. And as soon as I lay down to sleep, maybe 10 or 15 minutes, bang, bang, bang! Chinese New Year, or whatever it was. Firecrackers were going off, and it's supposed to be illegal. You know, not allowed to have firecrackers, and you get them somewhere, and you go bang, 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 all over the place. That's the 1 o'clock that I get to sleep now. But that's life, you accept that. So you don't complain. It's not the best. It's not the best, but it's good enough. Which means that instead of trying to make things better by waiting until you go home, so you can have this beautiful dinner tomorrow night, instead of thinking like that, we say, I'm going to enjoy this moment. It's not the best, it's got things lacking, but it's really good enough to build contentment. When we know how to build contentment, you know, when you go back to work, you've got a boss, and the boss calls you stupid and incompetent and hopeless. And you reply, yes, boss, but you're the one who hired me. So who's the stupid? Or your mother-in-law says, you know, that, you know, you're not looking after your son. And he said, well, you know, you brought him up. So, you know, that's, you know, don't complain about me. You started the product. I'm just trying to fix it up. Whatever you do in your life, you know, it's not going to be perfect, but if it really was, there'd be no learning, no growth. I did mention earlier, it's okay not to be perfect. And in fact, the trees which aren't perfect are always the most beautiful, the ones I like to go back to again and again and again. The twisted, the ones which have got damage on their bark. I remember telling that story, and it really hit home on people who had a difficult childhood, who really thought they were damaged goods and thought that stigmatized them. I said, this doesn't stigmatize you. It makes you more charming, more beautiful, the sort of person I'd like to be with, not sort of the perfect ones. Perfect ones would embarrass you, wouldn't they? That's sometimes the reason why I tell my monks, sometimes my robe falls off. I said, I do that on purpose. Otherwise you'll think I'm too perfect, and that would embarrass you. It's out of compassion that sometimes you fall asleep in public when you're meditating. So all of you don't feel so inferior. And actually, Brahm can fall asleep, then I can fall asleep too. No, it's just learning not to be worried about perfection and to realize that little mistakes you make, even if it's like big difficulties in your childhood, in your upbringing, you've gone through hell, but you managed to survive, don't look at it as a stigma. Look upon it as this beautiful addition, an embellishment, adornment on you. Just like a tree which is twisted and bent becomes some of the most beautiful trees in the forest. Just like if there's a fire in Australia, if there is a bit of dust on the horizon, especially from the monastery where I live, you get the most beautiful sunsets when there's some imperfection, some dust or smoke on the horizon. It serves actually to spread the golds and crimsons of the sunset across the sky. Sometimes it's such a perfectly clear blue sky that when the sun goes down, colours don't spread. So sometimes you change your whole idea of what perfection is. Perfection is not trying to change things. It's caring for things and appreciating them. Open the door of your heart to things. That's real perfection. A good example of that. I tell even monks, it's okay not to be perfect. You can make mistakes. And of course, when I say that, people don't make so many mistakes. And it was that time when I was in Thailand, 9 years in Thailand, I learned Thai and Lao, and I was very fluent at that time. And I would be invited to actually to other monasteries, just like I'm invited now to give talks in English all over the world. Not all over the world, but in Thailand. I was invited to go and give Dhamma talks in Thai. And everybody could understand it and were very impressed. But then going back to Australia, you didn't use your Thai enough. And which meant it just really got rusty. And, because of non-use, because of speaking English all the time, that it got sort of a little bit sort of rough. But it did happen one day that a group of people came over from Thailand and they insisted on listening to a Dhamma talk in Thai for about 20 minutes. And so I'm always willing to serve in whatever way I could. So I really put a lot of meditation, mindfulness and care into my talk in Thai. And I was very pleased that after I finished the talk, sadhu, sadhu, that's amazing, that's wonderful, we're so impressed. I thought, wow, I never thought my Thai was so good. It was in Thai. We all thought it was in Pali. That's the first time you've ever heard a talk from beginning to end in Pali. It's nice to be able to actually make people happy, even though it makes silly mistakes. Now that's perfection. And people would rather have that than another talk in a Thai language, which could be given by many, many Thai speaking monks. So that they really enjoyed. And also, it was that maybe I got this from when I was a school teacher again, going back to being a school teacher, that when I set my first exam in maths, and I had to ask, well, how did you do that? I was never taught how to do exams. Not to pass them, yes, but to set them. So the teacher, the head of the maths department, told me, please don't make it too hard. This even it was not an important exam, I think it was a midterm exam. If all of your students only get about maybe 20%, 30% average, they will not blame me for setting a too tough exam. They will come away thinking they can't do maths, like many people do. You get one poor exam result, you think, I'm hopeless at maths. That's not what's going on. So they said, don't make it too easy either. Because if everyone gets 95, 99, 100%, then there's no point to it. They said, please try as best you can to aim for 70% average pass mark. And it became what I call the 70% rule. Because if it's roughly 70%, if you get 70% in an exam, then it's a good result. You feel, that's not bad. At least you've come away thinking that, yes, you're competent in mathematics. And the 30% where you make mistakes, you always was fired as a teacher. It always had been the same places they made mistakes. That's where I could identify their weak points. Places where I thought I'd explained, you know, that part of mathematics or algebra, and they obviously had not understood it. So the 30% wasn't actually sort of stigmatizing or diminishing them. That was my feedback. So as their teacher, I could focus on that in the future lessons. So that's why a little bit of failure is great, because that's where you get feedback, that's where you learn, and that's where you grow. So that's why don't be afraid if you make mistakes, because that's where you grow from. If it's really perfect, life would be fun, but no meaning to it at all. So in the same way, if you have a wife who's only 70%. Great. Perfect. If you've got a husband who is 100%, dump him. You don't learn anything there. It's just too easy. No real growth. That's only an exaggeration, obviously. So you see if you can see any faults, not as, oh, I'm hopeless, ugh, I've got to get rid of this. That is actually where we learn from. So if you've been sloth and torpor, restlessness, aches and pains, laziness, don't think, I shouldn't have been doing that. No, learn from it. Understand it, accept it, that's where you grow from. And if you are all perfect, if you are all, every meditation sitting very straight and just getting jhanas and getting laser lights coming out of your eyes, all that sort of stuff, wow. It wouldn't have any point being here, would there? You should all be in monasteries or somewhere. But if you have few mistakes, great. That's accepted, that's growth, welcome. So that means that we accept this present moment, we value it. It doesn't have to be perfect. And often, because we don't value what we have, our partner, our meditation practice, our room where you sleep in, the hall where you're meditating in, your monk, your nun, the temperature, if you don't really appreciate it, you can never find any peace. Trying to change things outside is endless. Appreciating what you have, no matter what it is contentment and growth. Going back to the school kid, being a school teacher, because you know, he's in charge of one class, at the end of the year, I had to give out the report cards. There was about 30 kids in the class. And as I gave out the report cards, I gave the report card out to one of the children. He'd come bottom of the class. 30th in a class of 30. He knew he hadn't done well. But when he got the report card and opened it, oh, that was depression. His head drooped, his shoulders dropped, and you could see just he was getting very upset and depressed. He knew he was in trouble, but he started thinking, contemplating, what are his friends going to call him when they found out he was the last in the class, 30th? Dummy, stupid, dum-dum. All those terrible words you tell people if they come bottom of the class. And that was not the worst of it. What would he tell his parents when he got home? His parents would probably take all of the privileges away, you know, make him do extra work, maybe tutorials and all sorts of stuff during the holiday period. You know, you've seen that happen before. So many kids, they do get very depressed. And ruins their life. And even though I was their teacher, they also knew I was a Buddhist and compassionate. I can't just let that carry on like that. So I went right next to him and I said, you come bottom of the class. Yes, sir. Sorry. I said, no, not sorry. Congratulations. Well done. He knew I was a bit different. He looked at me, what am I doing? And I said, you know in Buddhism, you know I'm a Buddhist, but there's one thing in Buddhism we have, one concept called Bodhisattva. And a Bodhisattva is a person who sacrifices their own happiness and well-being for the sake of others. They'd even give up their life to help others. And I said, you are the Bodhisattva. You've taken this really terrible position of bottom of the class on purpose, so none of your friends have to suffer what you're going to get from your parents tonight. I You voluntarily gave up your own happiness and well-being so your friends could be happier. And I think, I know you, you can do much better than this, because you did that on purpose. You know, I know how much you love and care for your friends. People who sacrifice themselves are wonderful. Instead of actually just being so proud, and I'm the first, I'm the second. So you are my favorite kid. So much, I'm proud of you. I praise you being the Bodhisattva. I'm going to go to the principal after this class, and I'm going to nominate you for Bodhisattva of the Year Award in this class. You'd be so selfless. All these other people just wanted to come top and tenth or whatever, but you, you're the real McCoy. You love everybody. You sacrifice everything for all your friends. That's the sort of person who's a Bodhisattva. And as I was saying this, he was looking at me as if I must be the stupidest, craziest teacher in the whole school. But he laughed. It broke his depression. Overemphasizing. Just because you come bottom doesn't mean you're an idiot. You could have a class of 30 Einsteins in that class. Now, Albert Einstein, Stephen Hawking, imagine they're all in the same class. Just one would have to come bottom. So that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. But I did tell him. So you can please tell your parents this also. In Buddhism, especially in this school, you're only allowed, you're only permitted to come to get the Bodhisattva Award once. So next year, let somebody else in the class come bottom. So it's looking at failure in a totally different way. Be happy to be where you are instead of trying to get somewhere else. If you're happy to be where you are, it's very easy to enjoy this wonderful last day at Chi Wei Caves Temple. Chin Wei. You see, I teach by example. I get it wrong many times. Chinsui Temple. But anyway, what that means is it makes you happier, peaceful. And you know, you don't fight life. You don't fight who you are. You don't... Look, come on. Again, the last day of the retreat. You'll be meditating. How many days now? 6 days. Do you think you're going to get enlightened now? Do you think you're going to get into deep meditation, see any nimittas now? Give up. Get real. And I think you all know just how sneaky that teaching is. Many people have tried that. They just, okay, I'm hopeless, but I've been really meditating and just getting nowhere. I'm depressed, I'm restless, I'm tired, I'm just hanging out until the bus can take me back to where I'm supposed to be going so I can have a nice lunch and dinner or whatever. But you know, there's a few hours to go. So you decide, okay, nothing else to do, you meditate. And that's when people get these brilliant experiences. Right at the very end, when they think, well, all these ways I've done it now doesn't work. So just relax. Kill time. Just let it be. Stop aspiring for stuff. And then see what happens. You find because you're relaxed, you're not trying to get anything. You've given up trying to improve your PB, your personal best. All that sort of rubbish which you should have given up on the first day. Then you find you're at peace. And finally you get it. What's letting go? You don't strive anymore. You relax to the max. And be peaceful. Peace. Give up so you're not trying anymore. Your sense of self, your ego, which has to achieve, which has to at least get something out of this retreat, which has to be better than your friends, which has to be at least on par with your friends, which at least has to be not so far behind your friends. Doesn't actually measure at all. Which brings me on to the no measuring meditation. Because I was a scientist, physicist, there was a very famous physicist called Lord Kelvin. Lord Kelvin was the founder of the Royal Society, which is for science, one of the oldest scientific societies still continuing in the world. And he also was an engineer, philosopher. He was the one who gave his name to the Kelvin scale of temperature. Much more logical, starting at zero, absolute zero, equivalent to -273 degrees centigrade. So our sort of freezing point was 273 degrees Kelvin. Zero means absolute zero, because all heat is like the vibrations, so that at absolute zero, there's no real vibrations. Even atoms are still, or molecules are still, they don't move. -273, absolute zero. You can't get below that. It's impossible, makes no sense. You can't get more still than still. So, this is Kelvin. And somebody, I don't know why they asked me this question, but thank you, whoever it was, a long time ago, asked me this question. It is, what do I think of Kelvin's great contribution to technology that and an industry, that before we can control nature, we have to learn how to measure her accurately first. So he perceived the importance of accurate standard measurements. So we have the standard meter length by which everything else is compared to. Time, what is a second? So a cesium clock, which is the standard, so we know exactly what time is, so it's consistent throughout the world. Weight, measures, all these measures. Once you can measure things accurately, then we can have technology and control the world, which was the goal of the Industrial Revolution. Measure your physical temperature, measure your weight, measure your blood pressure, so that we can understand if it's too high, too low. But when you start to measure things, then you can control. And the opposite, this is one of the great ways of insight, turn it around the other way. What happens if you don't measure? You can't control anything. If you don't measure your progress in meditation, then you can't control your meditation anymore. You let go. So, have you had a good meditation, bad meditation? Who knows? How can you measure? Peaceful? Agitated? How about stop measuring? If you stop measuring, you can't control. You have to let go and be free. What about your husband? Measure him 1 to 10? Then, whatever number it is, even if it's number 10, could always be like 10 plus. He's always controlling, improving. Imagine not controlling, not measuring people. Not measuring people by their IQ, their race, their caste, their religion, their gender. Imagine we didn't measure people that way. What would happen? We'd actually respect everybody. We don't measure people by their earning potential, by just so-called achievements in life. And then we can be at peace with people. We stop measuring. That's one of the troubles with IT, Google and Facebook, or collecting all your personal data so they can control you. If you don't have any personal data, how can they control you? Just like when I went to, because I'm getting old now, and that's more measuring, but actually that I, not joking, not 808, but 67 Western plus a couple of months. That's enough to get a pension card. a senior citizen's card in Australia. I can't take a pension. I thought, well, if I can get one, why not? So I decided to apply for a Commonwealth Seniors Card. It was good fun, because they said, well, first of all, you have to come into the office to prove who you are, because there's a lot of identity fraud these days. Anyone can go in and just say they're Ajahn Brahm or they're Datuk Victor Wee on the phone, but how do we know that's the real one? So I went into the office, and they said, okay, we need your ID, a photo ID. Can you please show us your driving license? I don't have a driving license. Oh, okay. Your credit card, sir. Don't have a credit card. Your bank account? No. Your marriage certificate? Your rental agreement? And I was saying no, 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 no to everything. Because I don't have those things. And they said, look, how can you prove who you are? And I replied to them, well, I'm a monk. For 44 years I've been trying to find out who I am. And do you think I can tell you? So it was really good fun. It's not very good fun for the poor clerk trying to do her job when I was messing around like this. This is who I am. I looked in the mirror and said, yeah, that's me. In the end, I was fortunate. I did have two passports. I've got two nationality, British and Australian. If I only had one passport, I just would not exist. I did have enough ID to prove that I am. It's wonderful being a monk. But anyway, it causes hell for those people who have to process me. But anyway, so at least I existed in the end. So I got my Commonwealth Seniors card, which allows me to get a free cup of coffee in McDonald's. But I never get to go there. But anyway. But life always wants to measure you. And you know the word for measuring in Pali? The word for measuring in Pali is called manati. The word for mind is mana. There's a connection there. Very deep linguistic connection. The mind is what measures. That's a great understanding of what the mind does. If you don't measure, then you can't identify. You vanish. You don't exist. The mind disappears when it starts measuring. Good, bad, who knows? That's the deeper meaning of that story. Stop measuring. Did you have a good retreat? It was a retreat. Good, bad, who knows? So, you've got another few hours left, so are you going to improve what you've achieved so far? You're making peace. You're not sort of making war on the last minute. The big push. Okay, I'm really close. I'm not really close. I see these flashes of the images. I'm going to go for it now. I'm really going to go and get there. I'm sure that the flashes, it's all there. All the energy is there. Forget about lunch. I'm just going to limiters and then. Lunch is more reliable. You know it's going to be up there. So little by little you learn so much on these retreats. Mana, manati. The other interesting thing about the mind and the sense of self, how it makes a sense of self, that because I was over in Europe recently, I actually didn't go this time, up to Cambridge, but I remember the old physics laboratories at Cambridge, the Cavendish Laboratory, and at that time it was really old and had so much history to it, and it was like a warren of these little annexes and little rooms, and we always thought that in some of these little rooms is some mad scientist you know, crazy fellow making a time machine or a laser which will help destroy the world, whatever, because that's the sort of thing you thought would happen in there. Just the scientists going in there and doing crazy experiments. And some of them did do some crazy experiments too. But in one of the rooms, which they showed us when we first went there, there was the room where Rutherford split the atom. And, you know, Rutherford was a New Zealand guy. Brilliant. In those days, they didn't have much material to use. It literally was just, you know, a few elastic bands and some tape. And I think he used some alfoil, you know, the aluminium or metal foil. And it's amazing, the ingenuity of how they can get these great insights from such simple experiments. A genius. But I always remember looking up the word atom. It comes from the Greek word atomos, which means indivisible, undivided. Which means that they always thought in Greek philosophy that the atom was the indivisible, fundamental, unbreakable part of matter. You can't get smaller than that. And Rutherford split the atom, which realized the atom was not the building block of nature. But he was 2,400 years late. Because 2,500 years previously, a scientist under a Bodhi tree split the atma, the atma, and realized the atma, the soul, was not indivisible, was not the fundamental building block of minds. And I always thought, hey, those two words sound extremely similar, the atom and the atma. And of course, they are. Greek, Pali, Sanskrit, all part of the Indo-Aryan language group. And understanding that just gives you a little bit of understanding what this sense of self. Atma is the Sanskrit, atta is the Pali, and atta. You know, is this not the indivisible essence of the mind? Really cool stuff. I like this stuff. Anyway, just, 10 o'clock. What am I measuring for? I forget about measuring. Forget about lunch. Please, I don't bother. So in the end, just, with non-measuring, and with the idea of meditation and freedom, there was one last thing, is a good place to end, is when in the sutras, I forget which one it was, but I have to ask Ajahn Bhamali again, give him more work. But there was a monk came up to see the Buddha, paid respects, and Ananda was sitting next to the Buddha. And he said, one who is fully enlightened, who's an arahat, never even contemplates or sees that they are better than anybody else, that they are worse than anybody else, or they're the same as anybody else. It's called the three conceits. I am better, I am worse, I am the same. And the Buddha said, yeah, I agree, that's true. And then the monk bowed and went away. And then next came another monk, said exactly the same, one who's an arahat, is abandon all sense of self, no more cravings, defilements, are going to get in, disappear, parinibbana, at the end of his life, or her life. So they never even think, or perceive, or view, that they are better than anyone else, worse than anyone else, or the same as anyone else. We said, yeah, that's true. And then the Buddha turned around to Ananda and said, those were two new arahats. He said, that is how a person who has seen the Dhamma, let go of everything, who is an arahat, that's how they tell me that they are arahats. They're not better than anybody else, not worse, not the same. They vanish. No more measuring. No more comparing. And there's no measuring, no comparing, no more improvement, no more shame or guilt because you're not good enough. No more struggle. You're at peace. You may still have a few twists and bends in you, but just like all the trees in the forest, you're at peace. Nowhere to go. Nothing to improve. Peace at last. So, now we give a 5 or 10 minute, no need for sardines yet, 5 minute, 10 minute toilet break or whatever, and then come back, we'll do another guided meditation till 10:30. Anguttara 6:49. Anguttara 6 is, that's where the person came up to say he was enlightened. Very good. Oh. When I get back to Bodhidharma Monastery, I can give Ajahn Bhamadi the sack. The services are no longer required. It's only joking. it's only a short meditation, just over 20 minutes. So, first of all, when you're ready, close your eyes. Now, with your eyes closed, just to make peace in your body. Sometimes a bit of movement this way and movement that way can help. Just making sure the legs are comfortable as much as you can make them. But don't follow your old posture, just because body changes. So find out right now, what's the best posture for you? You feel it. You don't follow the books. You follow your personal experience in the present moment, guided by kindness and wisdom. If your back needs to droop, let it droop. If it needs to be straightened up, let it straighten up. Check your body. Making sure the whole shoulders are relaxed, the hands are positioned well enough. Head is balanced. The brain is not under stress. You're not trying to get somewhere or fight things. You never disturb the sound of whatever's going on outside. So it never disturbs you. You come to a state of peaceful coexistence. Realize that in this moment you have last day of the retreat suffering. But this is pretty good. So accept it. Make peace with it. It's not suffering anymore. You're not measuring. You're just experiencing, not comparing. To compare, you have to have some idea of your past. When you really do live in the present moment, in meditating, you're just here in this moment. This is all you have. So you're at peace with this. You embrace it. Relaxing with this moment. This is the only moment. What you're experiencing right now, what's in front of your mind, is the most important thing in the whole world. And your only job is to be kind, to care, open the door of your heart to this moment, making a friend of this present moment. This present moment will teach you a lot. So please value it, care for it, cultivate it, look after it. and you are reasonably peaceful. Just to get an idea of non-measuring, use some imagination, visualization. Visualize you're the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, freshly enlightened. Feel the breeze, the birds, the comfort, the contentment. No longer will you measure yourself, compare, and try to get better. Your work has been finished. Done is what had to be done. Just imagine it. Nothing is missing. Nothing is extra. You're at peace. All work has been concluded. Never need to be concerned about material things. You're at peace, finished, retired. Retired from this world. Just the Buddha at peace. Nothing to improve. Nothing to be ashamed of or feel guilty of. This whole path, with its joys and pains, its inspirations and desperations, this whole path, you see how it all brought you to this one point of freedom. You can understand why when you're on that one part of the journey. But when you get to the end, here, it makes sense. You're at peace. The goal has always been here. Always been looking for it somewhere else. No more wanting this moment to be different. No more being averse, upset at other people's conduct, or your own. Your heart totally open. No doors. Not keeping anything out. Being at peace. At peace. So you don't need to do any more striving. No more shame. No more thinking if you get somewhere else or do something else, you'll be happy. Yeah, there's still suffering as long as you're alive. The end of all suffering, the complete end, aparisesa nibbana. That's when these five khandhas, components of existence, pass away. Never to arise again. Right now, you're at peace. Nowhere to go. No one to become. No ID. Nothing which can identify you. Because you've given up measuring. Free. floating in the air with nothing tying you to anywhere. No fetters, no baggage, no boarding pass for the future. Just free. No wanting, no craving. No aversion. Free. No trying to capture anything with ideas or memories. Real knowing is different than giving things a name. Just like a Buddha under a Bodhi tree. Peaceful. Knowing that there is nothing more to be done. So just a peace. A taste of freedom. A feeling of perfection. The fragrance of peace. No controlling. No guiding, no directing. You are still in this moment. The world outside is changing. You are inside, still. Inner stillness, outwards flowing. This moment inside, still, peace, not measuring. It's always the same. Just outside changes. Inner peace, your real home. That you're aware of. Just this. Whatever this happens to be. Not measuring, not comparing, not judging. Never fearing this moment is better, worse, or the same. No comparison.
as being free, like a bird, even better, just like a feather blowing in the wind. Light, free, at peace. Know where you need to go. Nothing you need to be. Those of you who are enjoying this, just carry on in the moment. I'm now going to get up to go to the interviews. It's now 10:30.